haven't found it necessary to indulge in either one today. Yet. Barbara and I are almost dead last night. But I had a headache and she was too tired. What do you say on Sunday morning after you sit around all week and or all weekend and listen to the kind of speakers that we've had ever since we got here Friday? You know, we've been listening to things about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been listening to things about God and about everything that can be said has been said. The only thing I could do this morning would be maybe to repeat and say it maybe in a little different way from time to time. I want to thank the committee for asking Barbara and I to be here. I want to thank all of the speakers for contributing to my welfare and my being and more knowledge about the Big Book and about the program. I've been watching this guy operate that is the voice of this thing ever since I got here Friday. And by God, I can understand why they call him Sick Ed. And I sat there and I listened to Tom O. Friday night. I don't know whether Tom's still here or not. But I want you all to notice that Tom and I both had to start wearing glasses at a very early age. And you don't know what that means unless you heard Tom talk. I wish that psychiatrist was still here. A thing or two I'd like to tell him. The one thing I'd like to get from him, he talked about a pill called Daprosol. And he said it would allow you to drink and drink more than you ever did before and continue to function. And he said it also would allow you to do other things you like to do that you couldn't do as much as you used to be able to do. If he is here, I'd damn sure get a prescription for something. And I listened to Willie on Sunday, or Saturday morning, excuse me. And Willie, she talked about Spring, Texas, and how big Spring is and how big it isn't. And Willie ought to be from Maysville, Arkansas. We had a fire in Maysville, Arkansas the other night, and 10% of the town burned down all the way, and we only got 9 houses left now. I can understand being from a small town and not much going on, Willie. And of course, we all got to hear Barbara yesterday afternoon. I'll say more about Barbara later on. We got to hear Olga and Jim and Becky. The only thing I could think about was those people from the little house on the prairie way out there west. And, of course, last night we heard that old fellow that talked last night. What is his name? Oh, that's old Wes, you know. Everybody heard Wes last night. I was in Florida not long ago on a program where Wes was, and one of the guys that had known Wes for years and years, he told me what happened with Wes whenever Wes took his third step. He said that Wes got down on his knees and he said, God, I offer myself to thee to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may do thou would take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power and thy love. And a voice from way up above came down and it said, what an order. I don't believe I can go through with it. Before I can even begin to talk this morning, I do need to tell you where I live. I live in this little town called Maysville, Arkansas. Now, I'm sure that all of you know where it is, where it's located. But just in case you don't, I'll tell you where it is. It's in the northwest corner of the state of Arkansas. It is the last town in the northwest corner of the state of Arkansas. It's right on the Oklahoma-Arkansas line. In fact, the back street of this town of Maysville is the Oklahoma-Arkansas line. We only have 2 streets. With 9 houses, that's all you need. Now, Barbara and I really do not live in Arkansas. We really live in Delaware County, Oklahoma. We live on the first section line inside the state of Oklahoma. But since Maysville, Arkansas is the closest town to where we live, our mailing address is Maysville, Arkansas. Our phone comes out of Maysville, Arkansas. But since we live in Delaware County, Oklahoma, our children go to school in Delaware County, Oklahoma. I buy my car tags in Delaware County, Oklahoma. I pay my real estate taxes in Delaware County, Oklahoma. And I have an Oklahoma driver's license with a Maysville, Arkansas mailing address on it. Now, that creates some confusion from time to time, but the real confusion comes about due to the fact that Maysville, Arkansas is so small that we do not have a bank. And the closest town to Maysville, Arkansas is Southwest City, Missouri. And we bank in a bank in Southwest City, Missouri. And where this really created difficulties for me whenever I was drinking, once in a while I would be gone from home for a period of time and I would run out of money and I would be hungover and I would need a drink real bad and I would wake up in some strange town and I would go into a liquor store to try to cash a check in order to get something to drink on. And of course, being a stranger in that liquor store, the owner always wanted to know immediately, well, you know, I've got to have some identification before I can cash a check for you. So you pull out your Oklahoma driver's license with a Maysville, Arkansas address on it, and he questions this quite severely, and it takes you 10 or 15 minutes to explain this to him. And finally, you get it explained to him, and he agrees to cash a check, and he said, okay, I guess it'll be all right. And you whip out your checkbook, and you write him a check on the Cornerstone Bank in Southwest City, Missouri. You sure as hell don't get anything to drink in that store, you know. I learned a long time ago when I'm drinking, be sure and not run out of money if I can possibly help it, because I couldn't cash checks. But it does help sometimes today. You know, today I can be stopped by the highway patrol, and he'll want to see my driver's license, and I whip this thing out, and I show him this Delaware County, Oklahoma driver's license with this Maysville, Arkansas mailing address on it. He questions this, and you begin to explain it to him, and about 30 minutes later, he said, here, take this back, and please, go on, don't come our way anymore. Because I am a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink of alcohol since October the 29th, 1969, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. According to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, my condition, which is the result of an allergy, makes me different from other people. It has never been cured with any form of treatment that we know of, and the only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence, period. Well, now, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea what was wrong with me. I had no idea that I was allergic to alcohol. I had no idea that I had an obsession of the mind dealing with alcohol. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you told me that I was allergic to alcohol, I did not understand what you were telling me. Because you see, I had always viewed an allergy as being something that would have some outward physical manifestations or signs. For instance, if I'm allergic to strawberries and I eat them, I break out in a rash. If I'm allergic to milk and I drink it, I break out in a bad case of dysentery. If I'm allergic to ragweeds and I get around them, my eyes will begin to itch and water, and my nose begins to itch and I begin to sneeze. And when I came in here and you all told me that I was allergic to alcohol, I began to look at me and look for those outward visible manifestations of an allergy. And I could not understand how I was allergic to alcohol. Because whenever I drank alcohol, I didn't break out in a rash. Once in a great while, I would break out in a bad case of dysentery, depending upon what I'd been drinking the night before. I did not necessarily have itchy, runny, watery eyes, and I did not sneeze whenever I drank alcohol, and I could not understand what you were talking about. And I would ask several people, I'd say, well, what do you mean I'm allergic to alcohol? I said, I don't understand how I can be allergic to alcohol because I've been drinking this stuff for 26 years. And that there was a time that I could drink enormous quantities of it and not get too drunk and not get too sick and not get into too much trouble. I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. And my usual answer that I would receive, well, that's all right. You don't need to understand. You just got to be aware of the fact that you're allergic to alcohol. Just you can't drink it, and that's all you need to know. And like Wesley, I ran around in this program for 4.5 years, not really understanding what was wrong with me. And not understanding what was wrong with me, I didn't really understand what the solution to my problem was. You know, in order to understand the solution and apply a solution to a problem, you've really got to understand what the problem is. And probably at 4 to 4.5 or 5 years sobriety, I became interested in really trying to determine what my disease of alcoholism was. One day I went to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to read in it and study the doctor's opinion. And in the doctor's opinion, I ran into this statement that tells us that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, and it evidences itself or shows itself by the phenomenon of craving that is produced after we take the first drink. And I looked at this, and I read about the phenomenon of craving, and I looked again at the word allergy, and I said, in order for me to really understand this, it's going to be necessary for me to go to the dictionary and look up the word allergy and see what it says. And I went to Webster's Dictionary, and I looked up the word allergy, and I found several different definitions of it, but I think I found the one that fits me as an alcoholic to the nth degree. One of the definitions in the dictionary says that an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance of any type. An abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance of any type. Now, in order for me to see where I might be abnormal to alcohol, it became necessary for me also then to look at people who are normal when it comes to alcohol. And I found out that 9 people out of 10 that drink alcohol have an absolutely normal reaction. The only difference between normal and abnormal is what do the majority of the people do. And if 9 people out of 10 react one way, and 1 person out of 10 reacts another way, then that one person is considered to be abnormal. So I begin to go to these normal social drinkers to find out how they reacted to alcohol. And to my surprise, I had never paid any attention to how they drank. I always paid attention to how I drank, and I always paid attention to how people who drank like I drank, but I never paid any attention to normal social drinkers. Now, I realized I didn't drink a hell of a lot. I realized that they would get a little tipsy and they would stop drinking. I realized that you couldn't call them in to stay in for the party after the party. They were always going home and going to bed. But I really didn't understand why. And I began to ask these normal social drinkers to describe to me how they felt whenever they took a drink of alcohol. And normally they would tell me something like this. They would say, well, we can go home from work and we can be all tired and tense and wrought up from the day's work. And we can have a mixed drink before dinner. And we get a warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling. And they say, we may or may not have a second or a third drink before dinner. And we'll go ahead and drink, or we'll go ahead and eat dinner, and then after dinner, we probably will not drink anymore. Well, they talk about this warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling. I know whenever I take a drink of alcohol, something entirely different seems to take place. Whenever I take a drink of alcohol and put it in my mouth, as it passes over my lips get a very hot, intense, exciting, burning feeling. As it passes my teeth seem to chatter up and down. And as it strikes my tongue begins to grow and swell and kind of goes around in circles. And it hits my cheeks and my cheeks begin to go in and out like this. And it passes up through my sinus cavities and gets up into my forehead. And I experience a feeling in my forehead which is simply indescribably wonderful. Now, I haven't even swallowed it yet. I've just got it in my mouth. When I swallow this drink of alcohol, the greatest, most wonderful thing begins to happen that I've ever experienced in my life. As it goes down through my esophagus, my chest begins to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger and bigger. It strikes my stomach and it explodes like a bomb, and I can feel it immediately racing out through my arms. And as it races through my arms, they get longer and longer, and it hits my hands and my fingers, and they begin to shake, tingle, and vibrate. And simultaneously, it's also going down through my legs, And as it races through my legs, they become longer and longer, and I become taller and taller, and it strikes my feet, and it hits the bottom of my feet, and I get that real hot feeling, and my feet get excited, and they get to want to move and on and shuffle and go somewhere. I have no idea what you social drinkers are talking about when you tell me you have a warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling. That kind of drinking I don't understand at all. I never... Also, in watching the normal social drinker, and again seeing how I'm abnormal to the substance known as alcohol, I begin to watch these people and what they would do when they went out somewhere to a party and had a drink or two. Now, my wife, Barbara, I don't know how many of you were here yesterday afternoon. If you didn't meet Barbara, I'd like for you to meet her now. Barbara, would you stand up, please? Now, Barbara is an absolute normal social drinker. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. Barbara and I used to go out to a dance together, and we would have a mixed drink sitting on the table, and the music would start, and I'd say, Barbara, would you like to dance? And she'd say, oh, yeah, I guess so. And she would reach over and pick up her drink, and she would take a little sip of it and set it back down on the table. And we'd go out and dance a tune or two and come back to the table and sit down, and the music would fire up, and I'd say, Barbara, you want to dance? And she'd say, yeah, I guess so. And she'd reach over and pick up her drink and take a little sip or two and set it down on the table. And 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours later, when we got ready to go home, I would look over at Barbara's drink, and the damn thing was still half full. She's only had half a glass of it all evening long. I also found out that with Barbara, if you could ever con her into taking a second drink, that she seems to get a real sexy feeling whenever you get a second drink in her. And I knew if I could get her to take two drinks, I could go home and get her in bed, and we could really have a ball. But I found out that she only had about 30 minutes to do that in, because she gets sleepy as hell after she takes the second drink. Once in a great while, I could con old Barbara into taking a third drink, but I found out that was a mistake, because she puke all over you every time. Now, this is the way normal social drinkers drink alcohol. Whenever I take a drink of alcohol, something entirely different seems to take place in my system. When I take a drink of alcohol, within just a matter of minutes, it's necessary for me to have a second drink. There seems to be something happened in my system, both in the bodily and the mental sense, which makes it absolutely impossible for me to take a drink and not take a second drink. Almost immediately, I've got to have a second drink. And I'll do whatever in the world is necessary to ensure that I have that second drink. I'll have it hid in my boot. I'll have it in Barbara's purse. I'll have it in the trunk of the car. I'll have it hid in the commode. I'll have it somewhere so I can always have that second drink. And immediately after I take the second drink, it's necessary for me to have a third drink and a fourth drink and a fifth drink and a sixth drink. Something seems to happen in me whenever I take a drink that it produces a craving for more of the same, which makes it virtually impossible for me to control the amount that I'm going to consume after I take the first drink. I drank alcohol for 26 years. I never remember drinking one drink of anything that had alcohol in it. Anytime I ever had a can of beer, I had to have a second can of beer. Anytime I had a shot of whiskey, I had to have a second shot of whiskey. Anytime I took a drink of wine, I had to have a second glass of wine. Anytime I had a shot of vodka, I had to have a second shot of vodka. I have never been able to take one drink of alcohol and then stop drinking. This is abnormal. Now, I always thought that the normal social drinker, the reason that they had stopped drinking on one or two or three drinks is because they were afraid they were going to get drunk. But today I find out that isn't true. The reason they only take one or two or three drinks is because that's all they want to take. The normal social drinker drinks everything, that all that they want to drink every time that they drink, because they do not crave alcohol. And Dr. Silkworth tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that this phenomenon of craving, this craving that is not understandable, or at least it was not at the time he wrote the doctor's opinion, is the thing that separates us from normal social drinkers. 9 people out of 10 drink it safely. 1 person out of 10 produces the phenomenon of craving after they take the first drink. Therefore, we are considered to be allergic to the substance known as alcohol. I believe also, in order for me to be alcoholic, I had to have something else wrong with me too. I believe that I had to have certain, we'll call them personality traits, certain character defects, or whatever you would like to call them, in order for alcohol to do for me what it did for me. Now, I know as a young kid growing up, I was a little short, fat kid that always wore glasses. And I always felt like I was on the outside of the crowd looking in. It seemed as though whatever the other kids were doing, I was unable to join in and participate in what they were doing because I was always afraid that I would make a mistake, that I would say the wrong thing, I would do the wrong thing, and that they would laugh at me and I would be embarrassed. And I know most of the guys that I ran around with when I was in high school, they were all into athletics of some kind. And I wanted to be a part of what they were doing. And I remember going to the football coach, and I asked the football coach to let me try out for the football team. Now, it seems to me that this is what he said. I'm not sure that it is, but it seems as though he looked at me and he smiled and he kind of shook his head. And he said, "Well, Charlie, I'm sorry, little short fat boys that wear glasses don't make very good football players." He said, "Why don't you go over and try out for the basketball team?" And I remember going over to the basketball coach and I asked him if I could try out for the basketball team. And it seems as though he said, "Charlie, I'm sorry, but little short fat boys that wear glasses don't make very good basketball players. Why don't you try out for the track team?" And I tried out for the track team and I did all of the things that I could do, wanting to be a part of and being unable to join. Also about that age, I noticed that these guys that I ran around with, we would be walking down the halls of the school, and some of these guys would have a girl, and they would have this girl pulled over against them, and sometimes she would have her head laying on their shoulder and looking up at them. And once in a while, you would see them around behind and underneath the stairwell, and this guy would have her backed up in a corner, and he would have his arms around her, and her arms would be up around his head, and she would be pulling him down, and he would be pulling her up, and they would be kissing back there. And I wanted to do some of that too, but I found out little short fat boys that wear glasses didn't score any better in that area than they would in the athletic field. And I know one time when I was about 14 and a half years old, I had gone to a school dance, and it was out in the country, and there was an old barn out there that they had converted into a dance hall. It was an old dairy barn. The upstairs portion, they had where they used to store the hay, they had made it into the dance floor. And the downstairs portion where the stanchions used to be, they had put in tables, and they had set it up where you could bring a girl in and you could have a Coke and do all these things. And I went upstairs, and the music was playing, and these kids were all dancing out in the middle of the floor. And I remember going over against the wall and standing there and watching them dance, and I saw a little girl out there named Betty. Now, I have been watching Betty for a long time, and I'd always wanted to do something with Betty, but I was always kind of afraid to ask her, because I didn't know what she would say. And as I was standing there watching them dance, I said to myself, as soon as the music ends, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to ask Betty to dance with her. And the music ended and I started walking toward Betty to ask her to dance. And as I got closer and closer to her, my mind began to say things like this. My mind said, "Well, Charlie, what are you going to do if she says no? And these kids are going to hear and they're going to laugh and you're going to be embarrassed." And my mind says, well, what are you going to do if she says yes? And you stumble and you fall and you step on her toes and she screams and you're going to be embarrassed. And as I thought these thoughts, my footsteps got slower and slower. And before I could get to Betty, the music started and a guy come over and grabbed Betty and they went out and started dancing. And I went back over against the wall and I was watching them dance and I said, "Now, Charlie, as soon as the music ends, you're going to go over there and ask Betty to dance with her." And the music ended and I started walking toward Betty, and as I started walking toward Betty, these same thoughts began to come to my mind. "What are you going to do if she says no, and these kids hear her, and you're going to laugh, and you're going to be embarrassed? What are you going to do if she says yes, and you stumble and fall, and you'll be embarrassed?" And before I could get to her, some guy grabbed her, and they went out dancing, and I went back against the wall. And standing against the wall, I said, "Now, Charlie, this has got to stop. As soon as the music stops this time, you're going to go with her and ask Betty to dance with her." And while I was standing there waiting for the music to stop, a big old tall, slender guy that I knew came sidling up to me, and he said, "Charlie, how would you like to go outside with me and have a drink of moonshine?" Well, now, I didn't know what moonshine was, but I was afraid to tell him no, because I was afraid these other kids would hear me, and that would embarrass me, and he would laugh, and I would be embarrassed. So I said, "Okay, I believe I will." And we went downstairs, and we went out to his car, and he opened up the trunk, and he reached in, and he pulled out a quart jar of moonshine. And he took the top off of it, and he took a drink, and he handed it to me. And he handed it to me, and I tilted it up, and I took a drink of that moonshine. Now, the feeling that I described to you a while ago began to take place. Immediately when it passed over my lips, they got that hot, intense, exciting feeling. My teeth began to chatter up and down. My tongue began to grow and swell and go around in circles. My cheeks went in and out. It went up through my sinus cavities and went into my forehead. And about the time I swallowed that damn stuff, well, I almost choked to death. You know, if you've never had a straight shot of moonshine in the beginning, you'll never understand what I'm saying. I damn near choked to death. But with the choking to death, my chest began to expand and grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger. It hit my stomach, it exploded like a bomb, it raced up through my arms, and they got longer and longer. My fingers began to tingle and vibrate down through my legs got longer and longer. It hit the bottom of my feet, and they began to shuffle, and he looked at me, and he said, "Would you like to have another drink?" And from the tremendous height I'd already grown to, I looked down on his head, and I said, "Yeah, I believe I'll have another." And I took that second drink of moonshine, and we went back upstairs, and I went over against the wall, and the music was a-playing, and Betty was a-dancing. And I said to myself, "Charlie, as soon as this music ends, you're going to go over there and ask Betty to dance with her." And the music ended, and I started walking toward Betty, and I began to experience some of the greatest things I'd ever experienced. This feeling of, "What are you going to do if she says no?" did not occur. Because I knew when I asked Betty to dance with me, she was going to say yes. This idea of what are you going to do if she says yes and you stumble and fall and step on her toes, that didn't occur at all, because I knew that I would be able to dance with Betty and there would be no difficulty. And I marched right up to Betty and I said, "Betty, how would you like to dance with me?" And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, fine, great." And the music started and Betty and I began to dance, and sure enough, I did not step on her toes. I didn't stumble and fall. She didn't scream. She didn't slap my face. And the music ended, and I turned to Betty and I said, "Betty, how would you like to dance with me again?" And she said, "Sure, fine." She said, "Charlie, I didn't even know you could dance." And I said, "Hell, I didn't either." And to the best of my recollection, nobody danced with Betty the rest of that evening except me. Every time the music would stop, I would ask Betty to dance. And we danced and we danced, and the dance began to draw to a close, and I found myself again doing something that I've never been able to do before. I turned to Betty and I said, "Betty, could I take you home from the dance?" And Betty looked at me and she said, "Well, yeah, fine. Okay, I guess that'd be all right." Well, I didn't have a car to take her home in, but I knew a guy that had one, and he was an old, tall, slender guy that had some moonshine in the back of his car. And I went over there and I asked him if Betty and I could ride home with him and his girlfriend, and he said, "Why, yeah." I said, "That'd be great." I said, "Get Betty and come on and we'll go." And we went out to the car, and we got the moonshine out of the trunk, and we put her up in the front of the car, and Betty and I got in the back seat. He and his girlfriend got in the front seat, and we began to tool it on down the road. And as we were tooling on down the road, my mind began to dwell on the fact, you know, that I'd asked Betty to dance with her. And she had said okay, and I had danced with her, and I hadn't stumbled and fallen and made a fool of myself, and I'd asked her to let me take her home, and she had agreed. And my mind said, I wonder what she'd do if I would take my arm and reach over and get her over the shoulder and pull her over against my shoulder. And as we rode down through their little ways, and I thought about that some more, I reached over and I got Betty and I pulled her over against me. And she just laid over against my shoulder and laid her little head down on my shoulder and looked up at me with those big eyes. You know how they do. And I thought, man, this is really living it up, you know. And as we rode down the road a little further, and I began to think about that, and I thought, here, I've asked this girl to dance with her, and I'm taking her home, and I've got her sitting in the back seat of this car, and I've got her head laying on my shoulder. I wonder what she'd do if I'd kiss her. And as we rode down the road a little ways, and I thought about that some more, I decided I would. And I remember reaching over and getting Betty by the chin and getting her head positioned just right. And I closed my eyes, and I leaned down, and I put my lips on Betty's, and I kissed her. And, you know, she didn't scream. She didn't slap my face. Her lips began to move a little bit, and she acted like she rather enjoyed it, and I knew damn good and well I was, you know. And I kissed old Betty, and it went real fine, and we continued riding down the road, and I thought, here, I've asked this girl to dance with her, and I've got her in the back seat of this car, and I've got her head laying on my shoulder, and I've kissed her, and I wonder what she'd do if I'd take my hand and I would reach over there and get hold of one of those things. And we rode down the road a little further, and I thought about that some more, and I decided I would try that, and I reached over, and I got Betty by the chin again, and I got her mouth positioned just right. And I leaned down to kiss her, but this time I didn't close my eyes because I wanted to see what my right hand was getting ready to do. And as I put my lips on hers and I kissed her, I took my right hand and I reached over there and I got hold of one of those things. Now, let me tell you something. If you're a little short, fat boy that wears glasses, and you're about 14 and a half years old, and you've been thinking about getting hold of one of those things for a long time, and you get one of those things in your hand for the first time. You know, I had never experienced anything like that before. And I'm not so damn sure I've ever experienced anything like that since then. I get to thinking about that today, and in the center of my hand just gets hot and... I get around one of you good-looking women and my hand's in my pocket and you see it jerking up and down. I'm not playing with myself. I'm trying to control my hand. I get to thinking about old Betty. Well, we probably better not talk about Betty anymore, I imagine. The point I'm trying to make is here's a little kid trying to grow up and trying to fit in what for him was normal society, the society of the teenage kids. Always feeling on the outside of the crowd looking in. Always knowing that whatever he said and whatever he did would be the wrong thing. Always knowing that these kids were going to laugh at him and he would be embarrassed. Scared to death to talk, scared to death to do anything that the other kids seemed to be able to do normally. Now this little kid took a drink that night of some stuff that they called alcohol. And that alcohol seemed that night to do for him what he could not do for himself. That alcohol that night seemed to become the answer to his problem. It allowed him to function in normal society for the first time. It allowed him to function in normal society for the first time without any fear, without any apprehension, without any anxiety. When he took that drink of alcohol, he knew that he would be able to do what he wanted to do. He knew that whatever he said and did would be okay. He knew that other people would respond to that. And not only did he know those things, he was allowed to try. And as he tried, he became successful at it. Alcohol that night did for him what he could not do for himself. Alcohol that night was recognized by this kid as being a power greater than he was. Now, it doesn't take very long for the human mind to become addicted to or obsessed with the idea of doing something. The only thing you have to do to become obsessed to something is to have a problem, find the answer, use the answer, and then have it work for you, and then later on have the problem, use the answer, and have it work for you. Very quickly, our mind can become obsessed, because that night, when that was all over, I knew that that alcohol had made me feel better than anything ever had. I knew that that alcohol was the answer to my problem, and I could not wait to have the opportunity to try it again. And the very next time that I could get something to drink, I drank it. And the same thing occurred. The old fears and anxieties and worries disappeared. And I was allowed to join in and participate and be a part of because I had alcohol inside of me. Very shortly after that, I had an opportunity to try it again. And I did. And it worked again. And shortly after that, I had an opportunity to try it again. And I did. And it worked again. And you know, this is all in the world that an obsession is. You have a problem, you find the answer, you try the answer works. The next time you have that problem, you don't go out looking for another answer because you've already found the answer. And you use it and you try it and it works. An obsession of the mind is nothing more than an idea that overcomes all ideas. An idea that overcomes all ideas. It wasn't very long after that night that my mother began to talk to me. And my mother said to me, she said, "Charlie, I wish you wouldn't drink alcohol." She says, "You have an uncle that's in an insane asylum in the state of California. And she said, he's there because he's a wet brain. And he's a wet brain because he's an alcoholic. And he drank too much alcohol." And she said, "Son, you're going to end up just like him if you continue to drink alcohol the way you're starting to drink." Well, now, on the surface, I said to my mama, "Well, Mother, don't worry. If I ever get like my uncle in California, I'll sure as hell stop drinking." Deep inside, I said to me, she she doesn't understand what alcohol does for me. She doesn't understand the way alcohol makes me feel. She doesn't understand the way I feel around these kids when I'm not drinking alcohol. Therefore, I paid no attention to what my mother told me. My idea that alcohol would be okay, my idea that I could drink it and not be like my uncle, was strong enough to overcome my mother's idea that I shouldn't drink. Very shortly after that, my father cornered me one time. I was about 17. And my dad didn't usually say too much to me unless it was something very, very serious. And he cornered me one day and he said, "Son, I want to tell you something." He said, "The people in the Parmley family can't drink alcohol." He said, "I tried to drink it when I was a young man," and said, "all my brothers tried to drink it," and said, "none of us have been able to drink alcohol successfully." He said, "I don't know what's wrong with us, and I don't know why we can't." He said, "I simply know that people in the Parmley family cannot drink alcohol." He said, "You better leave it alone, or it's going to destroy your life sooner or later." And I said, "Dad, don't you worry. If alcohol begins to be a problem for me, I'll do it like you and your brothers have done. I'll quit drinking." Down inside, I was saying to myself, "Dad, you don't understand. You don't know what alcohol does to me. Besides that, I'm going to be different than any of the other Parmleys. I'm going to be nothing like them." The idea that I could safely drink alcohol was strong enough that it overcame my dad's idea that I would stop drinking. Shortly after I got out of high school, I went in the service. Did a little basic training, shipped out for Bremerhaven, Germany. In Bremerhaven, on the way to Bremerhaven, Germany, I became well acquainted with an old master sergeant. I suppose the reason I did is because he loved to drink, and he had a duffel bag full of booze. Just before we got into Bremerhaven, Germany, we ran out of booze. This old master sergeant, he went into DTs and almost into convulsions, and as I look back now, I realize that he was probably alcoholic. And he said, "Parmley," he said, "don't you worry a bit." He said, "as soon as this damn boat docks in Bremerhaven, Germany, I'll have us something to drink." And the boat docked, and it wasn't an hour or two, and here he came, and he had two bottles of homemade German potato schnapps. And he and I began to consume this German potato schnapps. Now, about 3 days later, I woke up in a military hospital in Bremerhaven, Germany. And there was a doctor standing at the side of my bed. And he said, "Son, I want to tell you something." He said, "people like you can't drink alcohol." And he said, "people like you sure can't drink alcohol made from vegetables like they do it over here in Europe." He said, "you've already died twice in the last 3 days." And he said, "if you continue to drink, you're going to die from alcoholism." And I said, "Doc, I know that. Don't you worry. I'll never take another drink of that damn stuff as long as I live." But inside, I said, "that guy really don't know what he's talking about. He really doesn't understand that people like me are special people. And we can consume alcohol in cases and conditions that other people cannot." I left the hospital, went on down to Frankfurt, Germany. 6 months later, a good friend of mine, he ran the motor pool. And one night he told me, he said, "Charlie, I'm going down to steal this 2.5-ton truck. We go to town and get drunk." We was already drunk then. He said, "we'd go to town and have a party." I said, "great." I waited at the gate for him. He went down, stole the truck. He came back, picked me up on the way down the hill into town. We picked up another GI that was hitchhiking. Halfway down the hill, it was an icy, slick road. He ran off the hill, ran into a ditch. This guy was riding in the back of the truck, threw him out, killed him deader than hell. Adams went to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas with a court-martial for manslaughter. And they told me, they said, "Parmley, the only reason you're not going with him is you didn't steal the damn truck." They said, "the only reason you're not with Adams is the fact that he stole it and you simply got in the truck." But they said, "if you continue doing the things you're doing and drinking the way you're drinking, sooner or later you're going to get into trouble you can't get out of." I said, "I agree with you. Don't you worry about me. I'll never drink again as long as I'm in the service." But inside, I was telling myself, I was like the little boy that his mother told him to get over in the corner and sit down and shut up. And he wouldn't get over in the corner and sit down and shut up. And after a while, she said, "I'm telling you for the last time, you get over in that corner and sit down and shut up, or I'm going to knock hell out of you." And he wouldn't believe her. And after a while, she jumped up and she grabbed him and she whooped his rear and slapped his head and she slammed him down in that corner. And she said, "now I guess you'll sit down and shut up, won't you?" He said, "yeah, Mama, I will." But he said, "inside, I'm still a standing up." And I think that's the outstanding characteristic of every alcoholic, this obsession of the mind that someday, somehow, that we're going to be able to drink that stuff and enjoy it and do the things that we want to do with alcohol. And all through my lifespan, other people were telling me I couldn't drink. But my idea that I can drink was strong enough that it always continually overcame. I got out of the service, went home, went to school, got married, got a little education, had a fine young wife, began to work on a job. The job was looking good. I began to advance in the company. Things were looking up, and I set out to fulfill the great American dream of having the good home, the good family, being successful in business, and et cetera. After I'd been at that for 2 or 3 years, this young, beautiful wife that I had told me one day, she said, "Charlie," she said, "I love you very dearly." And she said, "There's something I got to tell you, though." She said, you're drinking too much alcohol." And said, "Because of the way you're drinking too much alcohol, you're doing things that you shouldn't be doing. You're laying out at night. You're not coming home from work." And she said, "I'm going to tell you something." She said, "Even though I do love you, and I love you greatly, if you continue to drink alcohol the way you're drinking it, sooner or later I'm going to have to divorce you." And I said, "No, honey, you don't need to worry. I'll be able to control my drinking, and I won't do these things that you're accusing me of, and it's going to be okay. You just wait and see." And as my job got better and better, and I began to advance in my company, and I began to get on expense accounts, and I began to do entertainment of out-of-town customers, and one day my boss called me in and he said, "Charlie, I want to tell you something." He said, "You're one of the most valuable employees that we have." And he said, "You do a job better than anybody I've ever seen do it." And he said, "You are slated to be, in a short period of time, the vice president of this company." And he said, "If you keep your skirts clean and do your job right, it won't be long before I'm going to retire." And he said, "When I retire, then you will have my job. But," he said, "what I want to tell you is you've got a problem." He says, "You're drinking too much of that booze." But in the evenings, I said, "I don't really care." But he says, "You come in here the next morning and you're hungover and you're not feeling good and you can't do your job." And he said, "Sooner or later, if you don't stop drinking, it's probably going to cost you this position that you're holding so near and dear." And I said, "Well, boss, you don't need to worry. I'll be able to control my drinking. And if I can't control my drinking, well, I'll just stop drinking." Well, you know, one day I woke up and I looked around, and I didn't have no wife. One day I woke up, and I looked around, and I didn't have no job. And I didn't understand what had happened to me. I only knew that the thing that I loved the best, which was alcohol, seemed now to be the thing that was creating problems in my life with people, places, and things. I certainly did not want to stop drinking alcohol, because alcohol would do for me what nothing else would do. I wanted to learn again how to drink it and have fun like I did the night that I took old Betty home from the dance. Very shortly after that, I met Barbara. Barbara and I got married. And as she told you yesterday, we had a young daughter, a baby daughter, shortly after we got married. I've always felt sorry for Barbara, because she met me and married me in the latter stages of my drinking. We moved from Tulsa, Oklahoma to this little farm on in Maysville, Arkansas. I became self-employed. All restraints regarding drinking were now removed, and I was free to drink any time that I wanted to, because I didn't have to worry about getting fired, losing a job, or anything like this. And for about a year or a year and a half, Barb and I got along pretty good. And one day she called me in the kitchen and she said, "Charlie," she said, "I want to tell you something." She said, "I love you very dearly." She said, "You're a good man and you're a good father to these children." And she says, "I don't want to lose you, but," she says, "you're drinking too much." And she said, "If you don't stop your drinking, sooner or later I'm going to have to divorce you." And I said, "Oh, Barbara, you don't need to worry about that. I will either stop drinking or I will control it to the extent that I'll never give you any more trouble regarding my alcoholism." Some months later, I woke up one day and I had had the papers filed on me for a divorce. Barbara had become fed up with my laying out at night, by running around, my going to feed the hogs, be gone 3 or 4 days at a time. And they laid these papers on me, and I was in a hell of a shape. And the reason I was in a hell of a shape is because this attorney had told Barbara, said, whenever they put the papers on him, said, "You go to the bank and you get the money out of the bank, because if he finds out you're divorcing him, he'll get the money and you won't have any left." Well, I went to the bank to get some money, and sure enough, Barbara had cleaned out the bank account. Now, here I am, left high and dry, No money to pay the bills with, no money to make the payments with, no money to drink on, no money to buy, you know, what are you going to do about that? And I did the only thing any self-respecting alcoholic can do. I went in the house, and I took a bath, and I shaved, and I put on some clean, sweet-smelling, and I put on clean clothes, and I began to talk to Barbara. I said, now, Barbara, you don't really understand what you're doing. I said, how in the world are you going to make a living for these four kids? How in the world will you be able to take care of them and work and do all the things you would? And besides that, you don't really know what you're getting rid of when you let me go. Now, I don't know what it is that I've got, but apparently Barbara wanted it because I talked her out of that divorce. She dropped the divorce proceeding. She put the money back in the bank. Life went on real good for us. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months later, my mind began to say things like, you know, hell, I'm not an alcoholic. I've proven I'm not because I've been sober now for 90 days. And probably if I took one or two drinks, I'd be able to control it, and Barbara wouldn't get too mad, and she wouldn't sue for divorce. And as time went by, I became more and more agitated with Barbara, the kids, and me, and the neighbors. And I wanted to feel better, and the only thing I knew that would make me feel better was a drink of alcohol. And one day I took a drink, and I got drunk all over again. This went on 3, 4, 5 months. Barbara sued for divorce. They put the papers on me. She went to the bank. She got all the money out. She left me high and dry. Had nothing to do. The only thing you could do, I went in, took a bath, cleaned up, shaved, put on sweet smell, talked to Barbara, promised her I wouldn't drink anymore. And you know, we really mean that. We really do. When we're alcoholic, and we're in the throes of active alcoholism, and we promise ourselves and other people we're going to stop drinking, there's no doubt in our mind but what that's exactly what we're going to do. The thing is, we don't know we can't stop drinking. And I promised her I would stop, and she dropped the divorce proceedings, she put the money back in the bank, and life went on at our home. And 3, 4, 5, 6 months later, I felt like hell. I was mad at Barbara, I was mad at the kids, I was mad at me, I was worried about what the neighbors thought. Here this woman's divorced me twice, and I've let her come back home, and all these different things. And I wanted to feel better, and the only way I knew to feel better was take a drink, and I took a drink. But now I had gotten a little bit smarter. Sometimes I'm a slow learner, but I'd gotten a little bit smarter. Just before I took this drink, I went to the bank and I got all the money. And old Barbara filed for divorce, and she went to the bank to get that money, and that banker said, there ain't no money up here, and she was quite surprised. You know. Now, she says, and I'm sure it's probably true, that's about the time she went to Al-Anon. And she says that in Al-Anon, they told her about the disease of alcoholism. And they told her about the fact that I wasn't drinking because I necessarily wanted to drink. I was drinking because I had to. That I wasn't doing the things that she thought I was doing, that I really wasn't having all that much fun. And because of the understanding of the disease of alcoholism, Barbara then called me and asked me if I would like to come home and if we could get back together. Well, now, I'm sure that's absolutely true. But I also think the fact that I had all the damn money had something to do with that, too. I give Al-Anon full credit for that. I really do. I think Al-Anon has meant as much in our life and in our family as AA has. I think Al-Anon has saved my life as greatly as Alcoholics Anonymous has because of the things that occurred in our lives after Barbara went to Al-Anon. She went on to Al-Anon. I continued to drink. In Al-Anon, she learned to do the greatest thing you can do for an alcoholic, and that's leave him alone. She let me drink the way I wanted to drink. She let me do the things that I needed to do, and thank God she did, because without that, I could never have reached bottom myself. Some 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months later, I have no idea. She asked me one day, she said, Charlie, I have a sponsor named Wanda, and said, Wanda has a husband named Floyd, and he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and said, would you be willing to talk to him about maybe going to AA? And I said, who? And she said, Floyd Austin, and I don't mind breaking his anonymity because he doesn't care. And I said, Floyd Austin? I said, hell, he's a worse damn drunk than I am. I've seen him in lots of bars. She says, yeah, but he don't drink no more. And she said, would you talk to him? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I would. Floyd came over to my house. Barbara and Wanda left. And Floyd sat down in my living room, and he did something for me that nobody else has ever done. He sat down in my living room, and he told me about his disease of alcoholism. He told me about his drinking. He told me about his possible means of recovery through the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me about what he had had to do in order to overcome the disease of alcoholism. Now, the thing that he did for me that nobody else had ever been able to do is he talked to me about his stuff. Everybody up to that point that had talked to me had told me about Charlie's disease of alcoholism, Charlie's possible recovery, what Charlie would have to do in order to recover from the disease. And Floyd didn't seem to give a damn about mine. He just told me about his. And he invited me to come with him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, God works in very, very mysterious ways. This guy named Floyd has never been able to get any long-term lasting sobriety in AA. He can get 6 months, or he can get 90 days, or he can get a year. One time he got 14 months. And I had the great privilege of giving him his lighter for his first year's birthday. And he cried, and I cried, and everybody else cried. And shortly after that, Floyd got drunk again. And Floyd will get drunk, and he'll call me, and he'll say, "Charlie," he said, "man, I'm down." And he is. He's been drunk 4, 5, 6 weeks, and physically he's down. And he said, "God, I've got to have help. Come and help me." And I go to Floyd's house, and I pick him up, and I put him in a bathtub, and I shave him, and I clean him up, and I put him in a car, and I take him to the hospital, and we check him in, and they detox him in the hospital. And when he comes to, I go up, and I sit down at Floyd's bed, and I tell Floyd about my disease of alcoholism. I tell him about my possible means of recovery. And I invite him to come with me to an AA meeting, and perhaps he can recover too. One of these times when I visited Floyd in the hospital, he was sitting in the bed, and he had his legs hanging over the end of the bed, and he was looking at the wall. And I walked in the room, and I said, "Boy, what are you doing?" And he said, "Hell, I'm watching television." And he pointed up at the wall, and I said, "You are?" I said, "What are you watching?" And he said, "I'm watching the Ponderosa." He said, "Don't you see Hoss and Little Joe up there?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." I said, "Scoot over, and I'll sit down with you." And he scooted over, and I got up on the bed, and I hung my legs off the end of the bed, and we were both sitting there watching the wall, and this nurse walked in, and she said, "What are you nuts doing in here?" And I said, "Woman, we're watching television. Would you like to join us?" She said, "I don't know which one of you is the sickest." Floyd is in a Veterans Administration hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas now, called Fort Rook. Floyd's going to die from the disease of alcoholism unless something takes place in his life very shortly. I don't know that he will, but I know if he doesn't change it, God works in very mysterious ways. I went to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with Floyd. He took me in on Friday night, Siloam Springs Borderline Group in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. I walked in the door of the AA meeting, and there they all stood, and you know how they are. They had their hands sticking out, and they were smiling and laughing, and they said, "Hello, Charlie, how are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you. Come on in here. You've been having a little trouble with alcohol, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I have." And I said, "The reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it." And they proceeded to tell me. One of these guys, he said, "Charlie, we find that for new people in AA, and it's not a bad idea for old ones, but it is absolutely necessary for new ones, we find you need to go to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week." He said, "You get to as many of them as you can, and you get the strength and the support from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous." Another one picked up a book, and he said, "Charlie, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "If you'll take this book, and if you'll read it and study it and do what it says, you'll never have to take another drink of alcohol as long as you live if you don't want to." And a third one, and he was one of these old bald-headed poots, and you see them at every AA meeting. I see two or three of them here today. Sitting in a corner of the room, and he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, "Son," now in those days I was much younger, and he said, "Son, someday you will find it necessary to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him if you want to stay sober." Well, now these people didn't understand me. They didn't understand that I had a farm, a red-headed wife and 4 kids, 2 bird dogs, 45,000 chickens, a herd of cattle, a bunch of hogs, and I had to work, and I had to work hard, and how in the hell can you work and support all these things and go to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week? Just impossible to do. But I said, "I will come to your meeting down here every Friday night, but don't give me any jazz about 4, 5, 6 AA meetings a week." I picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to where they told me to go, which was chapter 5. And I opened her up to chapter 5, and I read how it works, and I saw the steps, and I damn near puked all over myself. Admit that I'm powerless over something, has to be restored to sanity. Turn my will and my life over to a power greater than Jesus Christ. Who could do that? And I thought about what that old poot had said about turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. What they didn't know is I understood God. I went to church in a good old Southern Baptist church. And in this good old Southern Baptist church, I'd heard about God. And I'd heard about hellfire and damnation and brimstone and going to hell for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking whiskey and committing adultery. And I'd been doing that all my life. And I knew that God wasn't going to have anything to do with me. I knew he had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here, you send him downstairs. We ain't got no place for him. But I said, I'll come to your AA meetings every Friday night down here, and I'll do this thing the way I want to, and I'll stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it, and thank God for AA. They just reared back and smiled and said, keep a coming back. You know, any other organization in the world would have taken a little egotistical knothead like me and have thrown him plumb out of there. And I went to going back, and I went to the meetings every Friday night, and I went religiously, and I didn't miss a one of them. And as time went by, I got sicker and sicker and sicker. I got madder and madder and madder, and I got madder at me, and I got madder at Barbie, and I got madder at my kids, and I got mad at my bird dogs, and nothing was right. And the people in AA, I liked them, and I loved them. They made me feel good, and I enjoyed their coffee, but I didn't want nothing to do with their damn program. After about 90 days, I'd been listening to these people talking about slips, and I sneaked around, and I asked them what a slip was, and they told me what one was, and I decided I ought to throw one of them, and I did. And I got drunk, and I got sick, and I got in all kinds of trouble. Now, in those days, my drinking had reached this point. Whenever I started, I absolutely could not stop. I had to drink always until I got so sick I couldn't drink anymore. And in the last of the drinking, I would gradually get off of vodka and get on to beer. And after about 10 or 7, 11, 12 days of beer, then I could taper off. And 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks later, I come back to AA, and I walked in the door of the Siloam Springs Borderline Group, and there they all stood. And they were all smiling, and they had their hands sticking out, and they said, hello, Charlie, how are you? They said, man, we're glad to see you. You've been having a little trouble with alcohol. And I said, yeah, I have. And the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it. And they told me. One of them said, we find for newer members that you need to go to 4, 5, or 6 AA meetings a week. And one of them says, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Take it and read it and do what it says and you won't have to drink. And that old poot in the corner, he grinned at me again and he said, son, he said, someday you'll have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him if you want to stay sober. Now, these people didn't understand me. I said, I can't do these things. And looking back on my life at that time, I absolutely could not do these things. I had not been defeated. I was still in control of Charlie. I was still in control. I was making the decisions as to whether I drank or not and what I did and where I went. And I said, I can't do them, but I'll come to your meetings every Friday night, and I'll work this program the way I want to, and I'll stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it. And I came to their meetings every Friday night, and I didn't miss a one. And 6 months later, I was sicker than I'd ever been in my life before. And I didn't feel good, and I wanted to feel better. And I only knew one thing that would make me feel better. And my mind went back to that thing that always made me feel better. And it said, this time it'll be different. This time it'll be okay. This time you won't have to get drunk. You're just going to have a few drinks. And I took it. And I got drunk, and I got sick, and I got in all kinds of trouble. And 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks later, I come back to AA. Walked in the door down there on Friday night, and there they all stood, and they had their hands sticking out, and they said, hello, Charlie, how are you? I said, man, we're glad to see you back. You've been having a little trouble with alcohol. And I said, yes, I have, and the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it, and they told me. One of them says, you need to go to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week. One of them said, read and study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and do what it says, and this old poot said, someday. You'll have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him if you want to stay sober. And again, these people did not understand me. Again, I could not do what they said. And I said, I'll go to your meetings every Friday night, and I'll never miss one of them. And I'll do this thing the way I want to, and I'll stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it. And they said, keep coming back. 9 months later. Never missed a meeting on Friday night. 9 months later. Oh, God, I felt bad. You know, when you take alcohol out of the life of an alcoholic and you don't put anything in there to replace it, he can do nothing but feel bad because it's the only thing that's ever made him feel good. You've taken his medicine away from him and he can't feel good any other way and life becomes a living hell. And 9 months later, I wanted to feel better. And I didn't know how to feel better except to take a drink of alcohol, and I took it. And I got drunk, and I got sick, and I got in all kinds of trouble. This time, when I began to get off of this drunk, something happened that had never happened to me before. I began to taper off. I got so sick, I couldn't drink anymore. And I went to the liquor store, and I got my vodka, and I got my beer. And I began to try to taper off of that vodka and get on that beer, but the beer didn't seem to do anything for me. And I'd take a drink or two of vodka, and Barbara had moved me out into the utility room. And I was laying out there on that old couch, and I'd swear to myself, this is the last of this damn stuff I'm going to drink. And I'd drink two or three drinks of it, and then I'd pass out. And I'd wake up 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours later, and I'd be shaking and sweating and sick. And I'd say, I'm not going to drink, but I'd be so sick that I couldn't function without it. And I'd say, I'll take one more drink, and I'll never drink anymore. And I'd take a drink, and I'd pass out, and I'd wake up. And this went on for days, and the days began to stretch into the weeks. And again, Barbara did something for me that nobody's ever done. She would stick her head in that utility room once in a while, and she'd say, how you doing? I'd say, oh, God, I'm dying. She'd say, you got anything to drink? I'd say, no. And she said, I'll be right back. And she'd go to the liquor store, and she'd bring me that old vodka, you know. And I drank that damn stuff, and I drank it, and I drank it. And one morning, I woke up, and I knew I was dying. I knew I was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't want to die drunk. I didn't want to die drunk. I didn't mind dying, but I didn't want to die drunk. I've always had a great fear of dying drunk. And I knew I was going to. I couldn't eat, and I couldn't sleep. And I couldn't drink water, and I couldn't drink coffee, and I couldn't smoke cigarettes. All I could do is drink vodka and pass out and wake up. And I said, Barbara, I've got to have help. I can't quit drinking. For the first time in my life, I had admitted defeat. For the first time in my life, a problem had me that I could not control. I'd always been able to do whatever I wanted to do, either by lying, cheating, stealing, conning, or some way. I could always do what I wanted, and I couldn't stop drinking. And Barbara called AA, and Floyd and another guy came over there, and they took one look at me, and they said, Jesus Christ, this guy's dying. And one of them said to the other, he said, we better not try to sober him up here. We better put him in a hospital. And they said, Charlie, let's go to the hospital and get you well. And I said, no, boys, I said, I don't really think I'm that bad. I said, I believe I can do this myself. And one looked at the other, and he said, if that's the way he feels, ain't a damn thing we can do for him, let's go home. And as they started out the door, Floyd looked at me, and he said, he was crying. And he said, Charlie, when you need me, call me. And he went home. And an hour or two later, I knew I couldn't do it. And I called Floyd, and Floyd came to my house, and he picked me up, and I was sitting on the front porch when he came, and I had a can of beer, and I drank half of it. And he said, drink the rest of your beer, boy. And I said, Floyd, I don't want this beer. I said, I'm through. This is all. I'm never going to mess with this anymore. And I left that half a can of beer sitting there, and Floyd put me in the hospital. And 3 days later, I woke up in that hospital. And I woke up in a place that I've never been, not physically, but I woke up in a place where I've never been in my head, where I've never been before mentally. I woke up in a place where I had been absolutely, completely defeated. Alcohol absolutely whipped me in a fair fight. And I knew that I could never live without drinking. And I knew that if I drank, I'd die. And if this is not a hopeless condition of the mind and body, I don't know what the hell is. And I laid in that bed, and I thought about what people had told me. And I thought about what this old bald-headed poot had said about, if you ever, ever in desperation don't know which way to turn, he had made a statement, try a little prayer. And I said, Charlie, do you dare pray? And my mind said, no, you'll pray. My mind said, weak people pray. Strong people like you that stand on their own 2 feet don't pray. And besides that, God ain't there anyhow, and if he is, he wouldn't help you because of what you've been. And my mind said, what are you going to do if you don't pray? You're going to die if you don't get some help some way. And I argued back and forth, and finally my mind said, well, what would it hurt to try? It can't hurt anything to try. And I decided to utter a prayer. And I said, God, if there is a kind and a loving God, can you remove from me the obsession to drink alcohol? Now, I have no idea what happened. I didn't see any lights flashing. I didn't feel any winds. I didn't hear any bells. But the instant I uttered that prayer, I knew that I never had to take another drink as long as I lived, if I didn't want to. And I left that hospital and I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't ask those people what I needed to do. I began to go to 4, 5, or 6 AA meetings a week. I began to read and study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I began to ask God on a daily basis every morning to help me stay sober. I began to thank Him at night. And I began to do the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I had never realized there's two halves to our solution. I had never realized that the fellowship that you and I are enjoying today is just half of it. I had never realized that the other half of the solution comes about through a spiritual experience, which is brought about by the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know there was a fellowship and a program. I had been combining them together. I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did it to the utmost best of my ability. I began to experience the things that the big book tells us that we will experience if we are painstaking about this. I began to get the promises. I began to know and understand what a spiritual experience was. When I was a kid going to church, I had a big tall aunt, my Aunt Molly. We must have been mixed up with the Pentecostal church, because Aunt Molly went down to the praying bench one night, and she began to pray, and all of a sudden she fell over on the floor, and she began to kick and jerk. And she began to speak and holler in these unknown tongues, and she jumped up, and she started jumping over the benches. And I turned to my dad, and I said, "Dad, Dad, what's the matter with Aunt Molly?" And he said, "Oh, son, she's just having a spiritual experience." Now, here are you told me I had to have one of them damn things, you know. Thank God for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for Appendix 2. Thank God that I now know that a spiritual experience is nothing more than a personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. Thank God that I know that a spiritual experience is when I have become aware of the fact that I have tapped an unsuspected inner resource of strength that I identify with God as I understand it. As I work the steps, my personality changed. I am no longer the person I was 14 years ago. The person I was 14 years ago lied and cheated and stole and committed adultery and drank whiskey and did all the things that we practicing alcoholics do. Today I don't do those things. Thank God I don't have to. The only way that I think that I could help you understand what's happened to me is to compare me to another little story in another Bible, or in another book called the Bible. In the Bible, there's a story about a little guy named the prodigal son. And this little fella is a Jewish boy. This little Jew boy went to his daddy and he said, "Daddy," he said, "give me what I got coming to me now." He said, "I'm tired of living here with you and the rest of the family." He says, "I want to get out there where there's something going on, where there's some excitement and some bright lights." And his daddy told him the same thing my daddy told me. He said, "Oh, son, don't go out there." He said, "Man, there's things out there that you don't understand, and they'll kill you, and they'll eat you up, and they'll destroy you." And the little Jew boy said, "I don't care." He said, "Give me what I got coming. I want to go." And his daddy gave it to him, and the little Jew boy went out there. And according to the big book, that big book, he wasted his sustenance in riotous living. Well, now, I don't know for sure what riotous living was in those days, but I assume it's the same thing it is today, wine, women, and song. And he wasted his sustenance in righteous living. And one day the little Jew boy found himself sitting in the pig pen. You know, this is a hell of a place for a Jew to be. You know, they ain't like pigs. And he found himself sitting in that pig pen. He woke up to the fact that he was sleeping with the pigs and that he was eating the same food that the pigs ate, because the guy that hired him to do this job would pay him in nothing but pig food. And he said, "By God, I don't like it here." I believe probably that's when the little Jew boy took step one. He admitted his powerlessness and his life had become unmanageable. And the little Jew boy wasn't any better off, because he still was sitting there in the pig pen. But while he was sitting in the pig pen, the thought came to him that things might be better in his father's house. He said, "I believe that the servants are eating better in my dad's house than I'm eating here in this pig pen." Surely that's when he took step two. He came to believe that a power greater than himself could restore him to sanity. But he wasn't any better off, because he's still sitting in the middle of that pig pen. And he thought this over for a while, and he said, I believe that I'll go home. And he made a decision, and he got up and he got out of that pig pen, and he started home. And don't you know that's when he took step three. He made a decision to turn his will and his life over to the care of God as he understands him. And he started home, and it wasn't easy getting home. The path was narrow, and the path was crooked, and it had big stones in it, and it went uphill and downhill. And surely that's when he was taking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And as he got close to home, he looked up the road, and there stood his daddy. And his daddy said, there comes my son. And he held his arms out and welcomed his son home. Surely that's when this kid experienced step 12. Surely that's when he had a spiritual awakening. He didn't know his daddy would do that. He only believed that he would, but because of the belief he took, he made a decision, and because of the decision he took action, and when he got there, his daddy hugged him in his arms. And he said, welcome home, son. And he told the servants, he said, go kill the calf. We're going to have a feast because my son is home. And he told the servant, he said, go out in the field and get his brother and tell his brother to come on in here. We're going to have a feast. And the servant went out in the field where the older brother was. And he says, your daddy said, come on back to the house. Your younger brother's home. And we're going to have a feast for him. We're going to kill the calf. And the older brother said, what did you say? He said, your daddy said to come on back. We're going to have a feast for your younger brother. Your younger brother's home. We're going to kill the calf. He said, who did you say? He said, your younger brother. And he said, well, that beats any damn thing I ever saw. He said, here I've been staying home, and I've been working, and I've been taking care of the fields and tilling the ground and making money for that old man. And that guy's been out there running around with them women and drinking whiskey, and now we're going to... They said, that guy went out and started Al-Anon. I would leave you with two pieces of advice. If you're coming to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're thinking about drinking, or if you're coming to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't feel good and you're worried and you're filled with anxiety, fear, worry, depression, anger, and resentment, I would suggest to you that you might do the same thing I did. You might pick up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You might begin to read and study it, starting with the doctor's opinion. You might try to work the steps according to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not off of the wall, but according to the big book. This is where the instructions to work the steps are to be found. And if you would do this, I might say to you that you would have the same thing that I did. You may also experience a spiritual experience. And if you experience a spiritual experience, you no longer will be thinking about drinking. You no longer will be worried and afraid and angry and full of resentment. The other piece of advice I would give to you is this, that if you come into AA and you're thinking about drinking, if you're coming to AA and you don't feel good and you're filled with anger, worry, fear, depression, etc., and you don't want to change the way you feel, don't screw around with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is so strong that it may get you whether you want it to or not. Thank you all for letting Barb and I be a part of your conference.